Good evening and welcome to the February 2026 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. Tonight we have two stories about fighting back against erasure of our history. First, Gerard Koskovich returns with Dr. Jen Reck to share more about their research and a new book about gay history and gay life in the Castro. And then if you haven't visited Queer Art, that's a gallery and performance space located in the historic location of Harvey Milk's former camera shop, Finn Dearhart will introduce you to one of the space's founders, Devlin Shand. And of course, Rafe DeRozzi will be here with this month's HIV Roundup. So stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, February 22nd, 2026. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of February 22nd, 2026. President Trump recently banned pride flags and all other non-government symbols from being displayed on certain federal properties. This includes the Stonewall National Monument in New York, where riots against police raids in 1969 paved the way for the modern gay rights movement. This month, Stonewall's flag, the rainbow flag, was removed. But 2 days later, hundreds rallied at the site as local leaders unveiled a new pride flag. Several LGBTQ activists told The Advocate magazine that they would double down on organizing against the president, with the pride flag's removal symbolizing what's at stake for our community. Kelly Robinson, the president of the Human Rights Campaign, said, quote, "This is sacred ground. This is a fight that people aren't giving up. If the government's going to fail us, we are going to fill the gap. That's always been the role of queer and trans folks," end quote. New York City Councilmember Chai Osei sponsored a resolution opposing the flag's removal that passed in the New York City Council. He contextualized the fight to uphold LGBTQ rights in a broader effort to protect personal freedoms and quality of life. Osei said, "What we should be doing as queer members of the City Council and as a city as a whole is to make sure we're actually protecting the bodies of our neighbors, making sure they have gender-affirming care, and protecting most especially our trans siblings, to ensure that they have affordable housing." And in the state of Indiana, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles has quietly banned residents from changing their gender markers on state identification documents. The Bureau of Motor Vehicles added a small notice to its website this month stating that it will no longer accept court orders or medical documentations recognizing transgender residents' gender changes. The rule goes into effect this month. This rule has been proposed twice before, once back in July and then again in November, but was met with an ire of Hoosiers who submitted thousands of emails and public testimonies against it. The policy was withdrawn each time, only to be enacted this month without comment. Only three states, Florida, Tennessee, and Texas, completely prohibit residents from updating their gender markers on state identification cards. 10 other states require proof of surgery and a court order. At the federal level, President Trump didn't just ban changing one's gender on passports or other federal documents immediately upon taking office in 2025, but his administration forcefully altered existing documents to reflect assigned sex at birth and did away with a gender-neutral X marker. Although the policy was challenged in court, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the federal government. And here in California, a state court this month ordered a San Diego Children's Hospital to continue providing gender-affirming hormone therapy and puberty blockers to trans youth for at least one more month. The court ruling gives local families and patients until March 10th to find similar care elsewhere, at which point another court hearing will determine whether the hospital has to continue to offer such care. Rady's Children's Hospital stopped providing such care earlier this month in response to the current presidential administration's threat to end federal funding to medical institutions that offer gender-affirming health care. However, the state of California has sued the hospital, saying it was contractually obligated to provide this care. Superior Court Judge Matthew Brainer said the case involved, quote, "an extraordinarily thorny issue that placed the hospital between a rock and a hard place." But he said that ending the care would place the hospital's 1,900 transgender youth patients under, quote, "a risk of relative harm." The hospital said it decided to end trans youth care under pressure from the president, who pledged to block research and educational grants, as well as Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement, to institutions that provide gender-affirming care to minors. Medicaid funding makes up about 37% of the hospital's operating revenue. And here in the Bay Area, after a two-year, $41 million renovation and restoration, the historic Castro Theater in San Francisco's LGBTQ neighborhood reopened this month. Mary Condi, who's the Senior Vice President for Theater Management at Another Planet Entertainment, was joined by Senator Scott Wiener and Mayor Daniel Lurie to cut the ribbon and officially open the theater. The remodeled theater will offer a mix of films and live entertainment, which started this week with a residency of genderqueer, non-binary pop star Sam Smith. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. Well, as you just heard in the news segment, earlier this month, the Trump administration ordered the removal of the Rainbow Pride flag from the National Monument at the Stonewall Inn in New York. And as efforts like this to erase our history continue, our first guests tonight are working to uncover and preserve it. Gerard Koskovich is back this month along with his research partner, Dr. Jen Reck. They've published a new book called The Castro, the story of San Francisco's best-known LGBTQ+ neighborhood. Gerard and Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Pleased to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back, Gerard. You were just on last month and mentioned this new book that you were working on, and that piqued my interest. And you both are longtime historians. Why now? What prompted you to get interested in publishing a really amazing, detailed history of the Castro?
Well, I have always approached my historical work through the lens of being a sociologist and doing sociological work that has a historical bent. And I've taught about LGBTQ history, especially San Francisco, for quite a long time. And so for me, this kind of came through the avenue more of my community engaged work, working with the Castro LGBTQ Cultural District. And Gerard and I were hired by the Cultural District to do a short historical context statement for a city report that cultural districts are required to do called the Chess Report. And so he and I worked together, and instead of writing a short context statement, our first draft was about 50 pages or so, when the end goal was supposed to be 3 pages. And so it's sort of like it came out of our community engagement with the cultural district and was propelled, I think, by our excitement about the history we were finding.
I'll add that this is one of the cases where, as an independent scholar, a public historian, I'm occasionally asked to take on these sorts of tasks because someone has to do them. And so the cultural district needed this brief assessment of the history of the Castro's emergence as a gay neighborhood. And frankly, at the outset, it struck me, my, this sounds really boring. Hasn't this already been done? Don't we already know everything there is to know? But somebody has to write this brief thing. And once we plunged into it, it turned out I was completely wrong, and that there were these amazing stories that no one had found, not only for the early time period that no one had looked at all, but even for periods of time that I've lived through living in the Castro District. A reminder that whatever one's personal experience, it's a tiny fragment in a very complex mosaic. So I even learned vast amounts about the 30 plus years that I've lived in San Francisco and the 50 years since I first went to the Castro when I was an undergraduate. So it turned out to be so exciting that, as Jen said, we couldn't confine ourselves to the short text. And fortunately, Tina Aguirre, the director of the cultural district, told us up front, we need to have this short thing, but feel free to write as long as you like, and we'll figure out some way to get that out to the public as well. We received proper honoraria that allowed us to do that. And so we ended up not only with the short text of a few pages in this official city report, but then with, which ended up being a kind of executive summary of the longer publication. So now we have, we don't refer to it as a book, we refer to it as a booklet. It's 54 pages. It's extensively illustrated. It has an in-depth bibliography. And it was so inspiring that, of course, once we got done, Jen and I looked at each other and said, well, really, this is the proposal for a full-scale 400 or 500-page book on the history of Eureka Valley and the Castro. And so we're now moving forward with that project. And eager to hear from people with stories, with documents, with photos, with film, with video, with further information that will help us document the incredibly rich and little known history of this neighborhood.
Well, I think there's a lot of mythology around LGBT history in general. I mean, if you ask the average person on the street who might know something, they'd say, "Oh, well, it all started with Stonewall." And I think there's a similar mythology that gay life in San Francisco started in the 70s in the Castro. And that, of course, is just not true. And you found out that the Castro has been a gay neighborhood, or at least had a gay presence for many years. Tell us about that. What did you discover?
Certainly, one of the things I was eager to do was to go beyond what I refer to more as folk historiography rather than mythology. I don't want to suggest that people are wrong to have these conventionalized stories about the past. Those serve a different purpose than critical historiography. And so for me, the really interesting question was, clearly somebody didn't throw a big switch in 1970 and turn the Castro into a gay neighborhood. I already knew that the first gay bar in the neighborhood opened in 1963, called the Missouri Mule, now the location of the Bow Dance Bar. And it was an outlying neighborhood that had no other gay businesses or vice businesses. That led me to conclude immediately the person who opened that bar already had to have a big enough social network within the immediate proximity of that bar to say, hey, this would be a safe place to open my business. You don't open a bar in the middle of nowhere with no customers and hope to stay in business. So that led me to kind of figure, okay, there has to be a much longer history of development. And what we ultimately found, and we're finding more even now, is that we can look back to the first half of the 1950s to find the first households of adult lesbians and gay men in the Eureka Valley Castro neighborhood. And we're probably going to find a few that date back to the 1940s with further leads that I'm following. So that was the first point you started to see a kind of conglomeration. Then this bar opens in 1963. That's the first queer business. By the end of the 1960s, five more bars had opened, a dozen businesses that served what we might call daytime needs of people, shopping for clothing, shopping for services like an insurance agency. And the one that really intrigued me was that in 1961, the first free newspaper given away in gay bars on a weekly basis anywhere in the world was created in San Francisco. And in 1962, a real estate agency on Castro Street started advertising in that newspaper, basically saying, if you come to our agency, you don't have to worry about being maltreated or discriminated against if you're a same-sex couple or an obvious queer person. And by the following 2 years, three more real estate agencies had started advertising in gay publications in San Francisco as having their offices on Castro Street. So that is the kind of business that you might see that ad and think, what difference does it make? But what it really did was help give a real step on the gas to this migration into this neighborhood of a new demographic. If you know you can look for an apartment or look to buy a house from a professional and not worry about being gay or lesbian, well, you might start looking there. So just for the 50s and 60s, we found so much amazing material that really no one has touched upon. And I might add that it also tells the story of the neighborhood in a different way. We think of that period of the 70s as being cisgender, white, gay male clones in their 20s and 30s who went to gyms and wore jeans and expensive boots and had mustaches and paid overpriced prices for drinks, and that it was a certain kind of culture. Well, those earlier years, the very first documented households that we found in the neighborhood are a lesbian couple, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, and the household of a young African-American gay man who was inviting sailors from the San Francisco port to parties on Castro Street. So right away, it was already a more diverse neighborhood than people might have imagined.
But Jen, I want to talk to you about the history that goes back even further than that, the Gold Rush. Talk about why that time period was so influential in helping to shape a gay community in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, so, the Gold Rush was one of the eras in history that was just an incredibly significant precursor to the emergence of San Francisco as a city. And at that time, thousands of people migrated west in search of gold and riches and settled in what's now San Francisco as kind of a launching off point for the gold prospecting. And the majority of those people were men. And so at that time, what's now San Francisco became a place that had something like 95% men. Girard is really great with numbers. You probably remember the number. What do you know the number, Girard?
That's pretty close.
Okay.
The
So
vastly overwhelming majority in the first 10 years.
So it was a very male dominated space. And I guess male dominated isn't even exactly the best word. It was a homosocial space.
Sure.
And so there's just historians who documented really amazing kind of queer things, such as these dances the men would have to socialize and have fun, where half of them would dress in dresses and in drag, and they would all dance together. And so there's just a lot of kind of documentation of what people call kind of early queer San Francisco. And so that was really kind of one of the first times that I think historians look at to really, map out San Francisco as having a particularly queer culture, as early as the Gold Rush.
Those were almost entirely men who didn't fit in back home in whatever small town or dismal burg they lived in and thought taking their chances on the far edge of the continent might be a good idea. Get away from church, home, family, small town surveillance. That doesn't mean all of them had desires for other men, but that was a mighty good thing to take your chances on if you did. And San Francisco immediately became a port city that made a lot of its money off of dealing with shipping, merchants coming in from other countries, other cultures. And like most port cities, it quickly developed a culture that said, we're here to make money, not to give moral lessons to anybody. And so port cities are often places that, from the point of view of respectable cities elsewhere, are disorderly and filled with vice and not the sort of place you would want to take your grandmother. And so again, that created a culture that had an opening that drew in men from the region and from across the country as the city grew.
Is that why you think you talked about the large number of men coming? Is that really where the idea that you write about in the book that the neighborhood really serves men more than it has women? Is that sort of the reason why? Just because there were more men?
Oh, I think that would be sort of jumping over about 120 years of time. No, there are other reasons why the Castro neighborhood, as it emerged into its high cultural moment in the 1970s, was dominated by cisgender white gay men in their 20s and 30s. San Francisco went on in the years following the Gold Rush to develop a very lively lesbian cultural and social scene as well. By the 1930s, right after Prohibition, there were several lesbian bars in North Beach. There was a male impersonation club where all the performers and waiters were women dressed as men. A good way of marking yourself at that time, maybe as trans, but maybe as a butch lesbian. That early domination of men in a sort of 10-year period at the beginning of the city, what comes later is just the way that men dominate our society in general.
Well, I mean, there's a big conversation going on in our country now about racism, and our community, as welcoming as we talk about being, has also struggled with racism. What role did that play in the formation of the Castro? Jen, you want to start and then Gerard chime in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, I think as Gerard spoke to in, talking about, the 50s and queer people kind of entering the neighborhood and starting to buy and rent property, I think part of where racism inflects that dynamic is just actually in a broader nationwide trend at that time. Post World War II, with the emergence of suburbanization and the ability for largely white people to get home loans to be able to settle and purchase property. And the kind of development of freeways and suburbs and, you know, the white flight out of the cities that was not only like an example of institutionalized racism in the sense that families of color didn't, you know, were not granted those same privileges, but there was, you know, also a dynamic of that constructed fear of the city and white folks kind of taking their resources and leaving the city. And so the Castro is like many other neighborhoods across the nation where that did influence the white ethnic families who had lived there for, you know, decades to start to kind of vacate the neighborhood. So there were a lot of, you know, open places. There was just housing that was available. And so that's the more kind of, you know, not as visible element of how racism, you know, impacted the queer people who were able to come in and kind of revitalize the neighborhood. They weren't all white people, but they were a majority white people. And, you know, over the years, just what you see is definitely an interplay between, again, as you see, kind of as a core element, unfortunately, of a white dominated society, you know, the system of white supremacy just grants white people more freedom, safety,
Sure.
and privilege, you know. And so, you know, when we would talk to, like, say, BIPOC queer folks who would talk about, you know, loving the Castro, going there in the 70s, you know, and other decades, you know, they also talked about that interplay between kind of either being just kind of invisibilized, exoticized, accepted, but not necessarily having, you know, their race elevated as a core element of the identity that was constructed. And then you also have many examples of bars and spaces being overtly racist, you know, like double and triple IDing Black and Brown folks, not allowing them to wear certain clothes and gain entry in the bars, things like that. And so those elements have also created some very explicit moments of really wonderful political resistance and action, you know, against those practices, as well as really kind of highlighting the dynamics of racism that BIPOC LGBTQ folks encounter in the neighborhood.
I'd add that I often say that it's a disappointment, but no surprise that we find racism, class divisions, misogyny, sexism, transphobia across time in the Castro. It's part of the United States of America. It's not a utopia that's on another planet. What is more surprising is that fairly early on, we started to see explicit organizing in the neighborhood to identify and push back against those exclusions, those limits to belonging in this neighborhood that people increasingly imagined as a safe place for LGBTQ people. So by 1975, for example, a bar called the Mind Shaft, most recently called Lucky 13 on Market Street, was picketed over the course of a couple of weeks by members of Bay Area Gay Liberation for having these exclusionary door policies, for example, demanding multiple photo IDs from people of color and no ID from handsome young white gay men, or having clothing policies that clearly were meant to prevent women from getting in. And this picketing ultimately worked. So there was a clear sense of this is wrong. We want a neighborhood that really belongs to all of us. And it convinced the management to change their policy, to post signs saying they would not discriminate, to hire staff who were BIPOC individuals. And we, unfortunately, we have seen, or unsurprisingly, we have seen repeated rounds of these kinds of concerns with exclusionary practices, particularly in the nightlife sector in the Castro district, in the sort of a sexual economy of nightlife and cruising, and repeated organizing to fight back against that. And so in many ways, for me, it's a neighborhood that embodies the appalling history of exclusionary practices that are at the core of American culture and the proud history of people organizing to fight back against those and to change those things and make the neighborhood more open and more welcoming. And that really has become part of the enduring political culture of the neighborhood, to be on alert about these exclusions, to be organizing to prevent them, to constantly be working to create a neighborhood that has a greater degree of openness. And in the part of the booklet where we discuss the 1990s, 2000s into the current era, we bring in a number of voices of people of color, bisexual people, women, trans people, talking about their relationship to the Castro and how problematic and important it has been to them, that it's a symbol of an imagined place of belonging that's worth fighting for. Certainly, we also have a few sources with people saying, went there once, said not for me, and never went back. We can't think that everybody wants to come to the Castro, but it's surprising how many people do, despite these challenges, and how much they insist on claiming a place, even though it's difficult. Then again, that also is like being everywhere else in the United States. If you're part of a marginalized community, you've grown up from day one having to struggle to claim a place and to demand respect. So you don't stop doing that when you get to the Castro.
Yeah. Well, and it's so fascinating in that time period of the 70s, you talked about the mass migration that happened from all over the country, and some really phenomenal people that ended up making a huge impact on our history landed there. I'm thinking about Cleve Jones and Harvey Milk and Gilbert Baker. Really a phenomenal impact on local history and national history and international history, all from the Castro. So at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that you're hoping to find other people who have stories to share with you. Where can people go to let you know that they exist and offer to share their stories with you for this book?
We currently have a link that we can supply to a very brief online form that we ask people to fill out, basically telling us who they are and what time period they have memories of the Castro, whether they have documents or stories to tell. So we have a sense of putting them in our list of potential sources. And that's something you can share with your listeners. And we're very eager to hear from people if they lived in the Castro, if they visited the Castro, if they've never set foot there but have heard about it and have ideas about it. We are keen to have all those different perspectives.
Fantastic. We will get that link and put it on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page. And if you've got a story to share, get it out there for Jen and Gerard to use. The publication that is out there and available, tell us where people can go to find that history.
So it is available at various local spots in San Francisco, like Fabulosa Books and the GLBT Historical Society Museum. Fabulosa Books also has an online ordering form, and they can ship the book to you.
Fantastic. And again, we'll add those links at outbeatnews.com as well. It is a fabulous publication, and whether you're a local or whether you're someone new to the area, it is one of the best histories of the Castro that I've read. So, congratulations to you on that, and I can't wait to get my hands on the 500-page volume.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And now, here's Rafe DeRozzi with this month's HIV News Roundup.
Welcome to the HIV News Roundup for February 2026. This month, we are tracking high-stakes developments in state-level access to care, a significant shift in military policy, and the launch of a historic vaccine trial in South Africa. We begin in Florida, where the state's AIDS Drug Assistance Program, or ADAP, is facing an overhaul that advocates are calling catastrophic. On February 3rd, the Florida Department of Health confirmed it is moving forward with eligibility cuts to address a reported $120 million budget deficit. Starting March 1st, the income cap for ADAP will drop from 400% of the federal poverty level to just 130%. For a single individual, that means the limit drops from roughly $62,000 per year down to about $20,748. Advocacy groups estimate this will strip coverage from over 16,000 Floridians. Additionally, the state is removing Biktarvy, one of the most prescribed HIV regimens in the country, from its formulary. While a state administrative judge recently stayed a legal challenge to these rules, an expedited hearing is scheduled this week. We will follow up in March to see if the cuts were implemented as planned and how those in Florida have been impacted. In military news, the Department of Defense has issued a formal pause on all new HIV-positive recruits. Following an appeal by the DOD in the case of Wilkins v. Hegseth, a federal court has paused the 2024 ruling that allowed people living with HIV to enlist. On January 16th, the U.S. Military Entrance Processing Command issued a directive to pause the training of all HIV-positive applicants. While current service members with an undetectable viral load can still serve and deploy, the accession standard, or the medical and physical requirements a person must meet to join the service, for new recruits is once again closed while the Fourth Circuit reviews the case, prompting the consideration of U equals U or undetectable equals untransmittable, where the science states when a person living with HIV is virally suppressed, they can no longer sexually transmit HIV and otherwise can live a relatively normal life. The threat to HIV infrastructure is expanding beyond Florida. The federal government is currently attempting to claw back more than $600 million in CDC grants previously awarded to California, Colorado, Illinois, and Minnesota. On February 9th, the Department of Health and Human Services notified Congress of its intent to rescind those funds, claiming they no longer align with current administration priorities. These grants fund everything from disease surveillance to programs that study health outcomes for LGBTQ plus people. The response has been a multi-state legal effort. On February 12th, a federal judge in Illinois issued a 14-day temporary restraining order to stop the federal government from seizing the funds. This will keep the previously allocated grant money flowing while the challenge proceeds in court. In international news, the clinical trial called Brilliant 011 launched in Cape Town, South Africa. This is a phase 1 preventative vaccine trial. It's enrolling HIV-negative participants to see if a new vaccine cocktail can safely stimulate the immune system to produce broadly neutralizing antibodies, or BNAPs. Broadly neutralizing antibodies are essentially super antibodies capable of blocking many different strains of HIV before they can infect a person's cells. What makes this trial historic is that it is the first to be entirely designed, led, and conducted by African scientists. While a vaccine is still years away, this trial is a critical step in building research capacity on the continent most affected by the virus. Looking ahead, the 33rd Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, also known as CROI, is scheduled for February 22nd to 25th in Denver, Colorado. We will be monitoring the data coming out of Denver for the March roundup, specifically looking for new data on once-weekly oral treatments and long-acting injectables. If you'd like to follow along for more, subscribe to my YouTube at Raif Durazi. For Outbeat News In Depth, I'm Raif Durazi.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News In Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, you may not recognize the address of 575 Castro Street, but if you've ever walked by it, you know that this is the historical landmark and location that once housed Harvey Milk's camera shop. In fact, Harvey lived in the apartment above the shop with his boyfriend at the time. After Harvey left the space, it's been home for a number of different businesses, and today it houses Queer Arts Featured, a gallery space that features the artwork from many local artists. This month, Finn Dearhart met up with one of the gallery's founders, Devlin Shand.
Hello, it's Finn Dearhart with Outbeat News, and I have Devlin Shand, a friend and an inspiring person here in the Bay Area doing really awesome stuff. So I'm really excited for you all to hear about Devlin, their work, Queer Arts Featured, and everything that they have to say in the wisdom. Welcome.
Wisdom. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And you know what? I say wisdom on purpose. That wasn't just like a filler, because I really look up to you and what you're doing. And you've said things as we've had coffee before that made me think and have stuck with me. And one of the things that you mentioned was about a desire to reclaim a sense of revolutionary capacity in the Castro. And I'm curious if that might be a good jump in to talk about Queer Arts Featured in your journey. And take it from here.
Let's dive right in. So I am the owner and one of the co-founders of Queer Arts Featured, which is colloquially known as Queer AF. We've been here for 3.5 years. This is a boutique gallery and event space, and so much more than that. It's hard to encapsulate, but Yeah, when we started this 3.5 years ago, it was actually only meant to be a 6-month pop-up that was born out of a photography show that I was going to do. So I am a photographer by trade and had a series of work that was meant to go up 3 days before lockdown. And then, so 2 years after that, I was looking for a place to put it up. And 575 Castro was the store, one of the storefronts that was available. And some of you might know, but it is the storefront that housed Harvey Milk's camera store in the 70s, which then also became his campaign headquarters the 3 times he ran for office. So when this space presented itself as a possibility, my two co-founders and I decided, well, let's just see what's possible for 6 months and throw everything at the wall. So we really wanted to invigorate a space with such a radical and revolutionary history as a community space where people would have the opportunity to get connected, get engaged, get activated, and be creative because all of us are artists. And that, I was seeing how my artist friends were kind of suffering during the pandemic. So it was really important to bring art back into the Castro. There's a lot of art going on here, but our whole ethos is centered around uplifting voices and showing perspectives that are not, historically shown or, represented in the Castro. Some people know this when I talk about it, some people don't, but the Castro is pretty well known for being for one specific demographic of
Right.
the queer community. And our whole ethos is centered around broadening that spectrum and uplifting as many folks and showing people as many possibilities and ways that queerness exists in the world.
100%. I mean, I think that is palpable going into the store, but also events that I've been to there. And just the idea, again, this revolutionary piece around queerness. And I know that we need spaces for cis gay men, but also how we can queer that and invite people into a broader sense of identity, especially for coalitional thinking right now. I feel like you wanted to mention how this is so relevant to our times, but I think this is a great project.
I mean, we really follow in the footsteps of the people who stewarded this physical space before. Harvey Milk was very much a proponent of a rising tide lifts all boats, and that's what we're really working toward here is that the demographics change within the community, and I think that cis white gay men have had a lot of space, a lot of time, a lot of voice. I am one, so I can speak from personal experience there. And
Same.
it's never been more vital, especially as we watch, rights getting chipped away piece by piece. We're watching this happening in real time. It's really important to stand united as a coalition of people, as you said, and just, we are all bound by our queerness together, and the things that make us different are the things that make us stronger. And, we really need to learn more and listen more and see and be exposed to more so that we can have a less monolithic view of the world.
100%. And I think so many gay people, I'm speaking broadly here and generalizing, but I do work with gay men a lot. And I think that there's something about like the comfort of identity that removes people a lot from the politics of it and how they're inseparable. And I think that's one thing that I love about Queer Arts Featured is like it's just like politics, art, queerness, and identity. It's all like you don't, it's like a soup of experience, and the contact with that, I think, helps open people's hearts and minds and eyes.
Yeah, I think one of the greatest rewards that I've had running this space is to see folks who are coming from all over the world because this storefront itself is a bit of a pilgrimage spot. And there's many different kinds of people who come here, but the starkest difference is folks who come specifically for the Harvey history and then folks who are just coming to be a part of one of the most infamous gay neighborhoods in the world. And people will come in and you can see their shoulders drop. You can see they look around and see themselves represented in words on stickers, in pieces of art on the wall. And it's a very unique experience. It's a really unique thing to see people feel safe and comfortable, and that there is, there's no correct way to be queer, but it all exists together.
I'm curious, like, for you and your personal journey, like how this project is an outgrowth of your own personal journey. And I mean, this word spiritual, but whatever, like I'll use it. It's like a psycho spiritual journey of your own as you work through identity and how you're showing up in the world, what you're doing in the world with your energies and time in a capitalist society. So I'm curious, like what that's been like for you as a process in all of that.
Yeah, it's I think very directly connected. So my bread and butter, the way that I make money and survive in San Francisco is I actually photograph society events, so charity stuff, and it's a stark contrast to what I do here. And when I've been doing that for 12 years, and I started showing up, first it was pearls, then it was lipstick, then it was heels, and breaking these gender norms in what I thought in San Francisco would not be a revolutionary act, but it ended up being something along those lines. I think the higher your income bracket, the more bound by the rules of society you find yourself. And so being in these spaces in a gender non-conforming way, confused people and then excited them. And then it kind of became what was expected. But all of that to say, that was a really interesting, the notion that the way that we show up in the world gives other people permission to question the way they show up. And then also simultaneously seeing these rooms of vast wealth and all of this, these means and resources and how they are distributed or not distributed, that really was a huge inspiration as to in creating the space to really try and provide access. And in my dreams, and it has started to happen, finding ways to combine folks with absolutely no access to that world, often very intentionally, and my access into that world and bridging those gaps and bringing in different perspectives and trying to get people of means excited about the culture that really is the heartbeat of this city and of the Bay Area, is it's queer spaces, it's queer parties, it's there's a lot of consumption of culture in San Francisco. And so it was really, really important for me to be part of helping facilitate, generate more culture and the, watch the soup, as you said, it mixes up and it's different all the time. And sometimes it's tasty and sometimes a little funky. And but it's spreading, and that's the most exciting thing to see, the relationships that are formed here. But creative collaborations, just folks who might never find themselves in the same room together end up here. And yeah, I think this is really, my heart beats so deeply for San Francisco. It's the longest relationship I've ever had, and it's still pretty functional. And I'm still deeply in love. And so cultivating the energy that is why people move here has been really, really, it's been a magical gift.
I'm so glad that you're doing this. I mean, as I walk down the street, even in the Castro, it's like it's seeing that there feels so different than many of the other different stores in the area. And just what you see in the window and just the vibe, it's so like what you're saying feels like it's physically visually represented to my eye. And I just wonder, how people feel when they walk by that. You said people like walk in and see themselves represented. I'm curious about, like, for you, like, what's been the biggest challenge in this work?
Running a small, well, first of all, I'm an artist who fell backward into running a business, and a complicated one at that. We have 90 vendors in the boutique space. We rotate the gallery show out every other month, and we host an average of 3 to 4 events a week. So it's a heavy lift. And it's, I have great support, and there are folks here who really, it all becomes part of the fabric of the whole thing. But really, at the end of the day, all of that doesn't survive without money either. And the money is, I think it's a pretty broad conversation that's being had right now. And all of my small business friends I talk to are looking at reduced sales. And we're seeing an interesting thing here, even specifically now. Our events and our space has never been more busy, but sales are on a lower end because art is one of those things that doesn't feel like an essential, even though it's so vital to our being, so necessary. So, yeah, and I think that that's the thing in San Francisco in general is that these cultural landmarks are all finding a lot of difficulty providing their services and staying open. So really, and we're a fiscally sponsored organization, so we're not a nonprofit, but we can fundraise and grant write as a nonprofit, and that's all of this has been a very steep learning curve and quite the journey and adventure. And I feel like I finally have a bit of a handle on it, but it's really, I've never been more anti-capitalist than since I started running a business.
Say
But
more. I love this. Yes, get into
yeah, it's
it.
the hoops one must jump, the it's philanthropy is such an important part of the system that we live in, but it's only an important part of it because there is such wealth hoarding. And so we see, even with the generosity, which has been absolutely incredible to see in San Francisco, the generosity of people stepping up. I've seen a lot of, like, Oasis was saved by a massive donation from one person, one family. And
Last minute too.
it's remarkable, but then it also really strongly makes you think about what could be possible if there was more generosity, if there was better distribution of wealth. It's, I don't know if there's a choir that I'm preaching to right now, but that's sort of really where it centers is I forgot to mention, we take the lowest commission rate of any consignment space in the Castro. We take 35% of sales, and all of our events are, no one is turned away for lack of funds, and then ticket prices are all sliding scale. We're really centered around access, which I have no intention of changing. I would rather, the last people I want to ask for more money are the people making the work and the people who deserve it. So
It's so crazy and backwards.
it is wild. So just making sure that, yeah, making sure that we're stable and secure is the greatest challenge the long way around, but there's the answer.
Yeah, well, hoping, I mean, the listenership here, I'm hoping that, people are all different places and how they feel about capitalism or where their awareness is around the structures that are shaped psychically because of capitalism. And who knows? So if you're listening and you want to support Queer Arts Featured in any kind of donating kind of way, that's a possibility. But also hopefully people are just like coming into the store and making a trip here specifically to see what you're doing and be involved in what you're doing. And the
It is.
contact, it's a contact.
It is. It's really vital to come in here. You can't really understand unless you're in here and you're feeling the energy. One of my favorite compliments from people is, "Oh my God, it just feels, there's something happening here." And I can take, and we can take some credit for that. It's also baked into the walls. It's the legacy of this space is massive, and it changed the world for our community. And it's not something we take lightly. And that's been a really interesting, the intergenerational exchange that ends up happening here as well, because there are people so directly connected to the history. And we work with several elders as artists, as vendors. We did a show last year that was all centered around work that was processed here when it was Castro Camera, that had accompanying interviews. So I worked with five folks from the community who are still around, who were making photographs. Including Dana Galetta, who worked here when it was the camera store and did interviews with everybody. So there was this incredible mo an element of being dropped directly into the history of the space here, while in the other two-thirds of the space, you're seeing art that is not safe for work, art that is expressive of all different kinds of queerness and from different backgrounds and different identities. And this beautiful tension, not even tension, it was a marrying. It was part of the soup. It was a reminder that all of this exists and needs to together. And the more stories we can learn, the more things we can hear, the more perspectives we can get an understanding of, the stronger we are, the more ready we are to fight for the people that need help. It's, yeah, it's, that was a bit of a meander, but.
I'm in for it. You can keep meandering. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, actually, so this the legacy. I mentioned the legacy Is that something that you, I mean, you're informed by it, but like, how does that actually permeate your daily practice almost? I would consider this a practice that you're in.
Yeah.
Life path. How does the legacy of Harvey Milk and that era influence you?
Yeah, pretty directly. I think that just before we, started recording, we talked about now is the time to be standing up and doing more and saying more. And I think in our lifetime, there's never been a more important moment to use your voice, to use what you have as far as time, talent, resources, privilege, to make sure that voices that need to be heard are being heard. It informs the work I do here every day. It's just necessary. I mean, I'm thinking in my head about the Bad Bunny message at the Super Bowl. The only thing more powerful than hate is love, and this is a space that's really filled with love. And it was then too, I mean, it was different, and I think Harvey Milk did an incredible amount of work within the context of the world that he lived in, and within the context of the world that we live in now, things look so different, and yet we're fighting so many of the same fights. But it's so important to remember that we have to be doing this together.
What do you think would get more gay and queer pe identified people invested in? This is a conjecture question, obviously, but invested in social justice? I mean, I have my own thoughts about that from a psychological perspective. I'm just curious, like, what you think. Like, what would get men? This is riffing off of conversations we've had before, again, about what the Castro means and what it means to people now. And I've also heard, from Greg, our co-host for the Outbeat show, who brings high schoolers and college students to the Castro, and some of them have never been to the Castro, and they're just kind of like, they're just so lit up, and this kind of possibility lights up for them. But I think you're onto something when you talk about the way that the Castro, in some ways, has lost such a revolutionary kind of pulse. And yeah, just wondering what you think about that and why.
Yeah, I think the Castro is a has been in a bit of an identity crisis for a while. I think this neighborhood was born out of adversity, as so many incredible magical movements are. And that adversity has gone away for a large swath of the demographic that is here. And we all know the story of gentrification. We know the story of how expensive it is to live in this city. This is a very desirable neighborhood. So the folks who live here are, people of means who often don't shop here, who are, and the whole world has changed from when the Castro became what it was in the 70s. So my thought is very much about, how do we evolve? How do we change? How do we become intentional about that? I hear a lot of business owners and politicians talking about, we've got to fill the storefronts, we've got to fill the storefronts. But with what? We have to make sure we're being really intentional about who we're giving opportunity here. We may have to make sure that we have more business owners of color, trans business owners. We have to have people that are representational of our community if we want the whole community to be here.
I love that answer, and I think that's going to be a note that we're going to be ending on here in just a second. I think what you say is inspiring, and I love this idea of like, yeah, let's fill the fronts, but with what? I think that also is a parallel to what we're filling ourselves with psychically, and this is going to be my plug for Queer Arts Featured again. Go check out, if you're listening to this, go check out Queer Arts Featured in the Castro. It's in between 18th Street and 19th Street, is that correct? Yellow, pink neon letters. Yeah, I'm grateful for what you're doing, Devlin, and we'll be putting anything that you share in the show notes. So the link to the store site, the address, any other stuff that you might include from this conversation if it feels like you want to. So,
Fabulous. Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, we have some really beautiful things coming up. The show
yeah.
that's up right now in the gallery is a series of paintings that's an ode to neon in some in timing with the reopening of the Castro Theater. There are these gorgeous, huge paintings of the neon signs that we all know and love, and neon is such a symbol of, being seen from miles away, and queer spaces that have neon signs are revolutionary in and of themselves.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned like shows that are upcoming. I'm assuming those are posted on the website.
Yeah, there'll be a good swath of information on the website. We have a calendar there. There are many, many events coming up. Monday nights, every night from 4 to 9, we have community co-working. Well, it's evolving into a community space, and there are different guest offerings every Monday. So if you're just looking for somewhere to land on a Monday, it's a great place to be.
Thank you so much, Devlin.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our hour. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know. Broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains, we gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise like the day, I'll rise unafraid, I'll rise up, and I do it 1,000 times again. And I'll rise up, I like the waves, I'll rise up, in spite of the ache, I'll rise up, and I do it 1,000 silence is a quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we'll take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.